on one of about 30 or so cadets that were on an exchange with your ship. Guantanamo Bay, we flew down and joined her. Went out in the Caribbean on a gunnery exercise. And it's been one of the highlights of my life because here was this huge ship. I promise you, this is not a lead act. No way. As I can recall, the ship fired at sleds.
That's right.
About 20 miles away.
Yeah.
But they let us go into the barbettes.
Really exciting.
Awesome things. And then up on the 5-inch guns. And then the highlight was the fact they let us go on the Chief's Liberty boats to Guantanamo Bay. So they say, okay, now away the Chief's Liberty boats. You know, which is about an hour or two before anybody else got off the ship. And it was a great, about 10 or 11 day cruise. And one of the guys who caused us some heartburn, not much, but was a mission, first class mission.
He was a nut even then.
Well, that's exactly the impression.
I'm the guy that's responsible for
it. It was a hell of a thing. 20 years later, 25 years later, to see, well, here's the case.
Yeah, he was a borderline mental case already, I think.
It was a hell of a good cruise, and that ship was just a revelation of how to operate a big enterprise. No pun intended, but just a hell of a big operation. It went very well, very, very well. I didn't know about this until lunch today. Good days, these very days. And I suggest you run it down. I can see why we want to have that anchorage.
Yeah.
Ever since then, thinking about as the Cuban crisis came, as we read about Guantanamo, Admiral Buckley, with the water and all that, just how valuable that anchorage is.
That's
right. This is the various straits around the world.
We'll make peace with Castro one of these days, and his price for peace will be to give him that armor back. We'll have to give up my time.
You think we will?
I think
we should.
We have ourselves. Friendship with the United States ought to be, ought to stand on its own bottom. We shouldn't have to bribe a communist dictator to come back into the fold. Liquidation of the bases in Portugal and the Azores, We've already, Gorshkov says, gotten the Portuguese to announce that the Azores won't be available to the Americans in the next Mideast crisis, so that already gives them major problems with regard to airlift. The Portuguese announced about a couple months ago. We've got a cover and deception operation going on right now that isn't going as well as it should. We've tried to mislead the Western press about Soviet facilities in Berbera, and they've caught us a little bit with our fingers in the cookie jar, but we'll be able to fuzz that up enough that it won't look like the naked, raw, powerful infrastructure that it is. And meanwhile, we have slowed down the rate at which the United States is going to bring facilities to bear in the Indian Ocean with regard to Diego Garcia. And that's, of course, what our cover operation in Berbera was all about. We moved a Soviet ship out of the port near Qusair when columnists went down to inspect it not too long ago, and then moved it back in as soon as they left, and that went fine.
That was a doorway.
Right.
What kind of ship was it?
I believe it was a tender, but that ought to be checked. So we're getting...
That's what we have for the flagship.
Well, it was a Soviet ship that moved out there. Yeah, but not in Iraq. Our tender was in Bahrain. It used to be a seaplane tender. It's now an ex-amphibious ship. That's the flagship down there. So, you know, we've got facilities already superior to what the United States executive branch has asked its Congress for in Diego Garcia in Somalia, in the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, and in Iraq. Airfields, ports, Soviet personnel ashore, communications facility in Somalia, beautiful repair facility for our missiles in Somalia. You know, with those developments, the power balance, which was already favorable to the Soviet military capability in Eastern Mediterranean at the time of the Yom Kippur crisis, and which made it possible for your, Mr. Chairman, relatively savage note to go out to the President of the United States, which in essence demanded that the Israelis be ordered to release the Egyptian Third Army, and to which, quite apart from any political considerations, the Yankees had no rational military alternative than to comply. That power balance continues to shift to our favor. I will use those words, dear comrade, that you love so well. The correlation of forces has shifted to our advantage and is making détente irreversible. And as you know, by that we mean that we'll get the free world to continue to accommodate a slice at a time for our initiative. And we've been doing pretty well, so let's not spoil it. After all, out of the Yom Kippur War, we got the Suez Canal open, our long-term strategic objective, which makes it possible to flood ships in there to be supported by that infrastructure and three facilities. We recommended to the Arabs that they slap the oil embargo on the West. They did. We recommended they quadruple the oil prices. They did. We are exultant, as you know, about the fact that a billion people in the 30 underdeveloped nations face starvation as a result, and this is giving us lovely opportunities to radicalize their regime. The inflationary impacts in the so-called prosperous free world have made the Italian government shift left. We're going to get Portugal shortly, and even the Congress of the United States is cutting defense budgets so that let's just keep going like we're going. Now, the day may come when the power... Oh, did he? Not as much. Well, you know, the Congress of the United States ought to be asking why the naval budget isn't increased, not decreasing it at a time. The House has taken, one of the bodies has taken patrol frigates out and has cut down on PHM. The modernization programs that were going to make it possible for the U.S. Navy to have the numbers that would compete with us were the communists.
Do you
may take a little longer to convince the layman in the United States. And, of course, it's very important for us to continue that work.
Do you agree with the counsel?
Surface warship, because we know that although it makes a perjured claim that two ships of equal size and capability, one nuclear propelled and one conventional propelled, don't have significant differences in cost, that that's not the right question. The right question is, what would you build with conventional propulsion, smaller, that you can't build with nuclear propulsion? And we know that, for example, the Americans are going up 5 patrol frigates for every nuclear frigate that they build. And we're doing it just the other way around. We're building the 5 and giving up the 1. And that's in part the reason that we have 4 times as many ships as the United States have. The other part of it, of course, is that, as you know, our naval budget is bigger. As you well know, we're able to tell the press what kind of lies to print, and we link the stories in the press to national policy. They're obviously designed to enhance national policy. Our think tank, the Arbartov Institute, knows that it's got to link itself quite clearly to our national goals, and they work in very sophisticated ways to do so.
Are you saying that our system works better than Henry Kissinger's National Security Council staff?
certainly.
Admiral Moore and Admiral Zumwalt.
You know, from what I read in the press, Henry Kissinger is able to say a lot more to us than he's able to say to the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
He's able to?
I guess chooses to is more accurate, Tom R. Brisnev. I'm always amazed at how wise you are.
But is there something wrong with our system? Why do they have this fragile dialogue when I hope we enjoy such a good one?
You know, the Americans have chosen to try to create a governmental system which is almost exactly balanced, has checks and balances. They talk about that in their silly constitution. And the great fallacy of what that constitution had in mind was to make it possible for the human spirit to prevail, for individuals to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Whereas, as you know, it's much more important for the state to be supreme and to have a unity, coherence, and emphasis. We are and proclaim to be an offensive alliance. We know that our goal is to create a power structure which makes it possible for us to work our will around the world. And we link our press, our public, our military, our political all together in the achievement of that goal. Sure, we have to pay some lip service to the aspirations of the people, and we've permitted the slope of rising expectations to come up at about a tenth of the rate that it has to under the American system. But we have been able to devote over twice the fraction of our gross national product to military capability that the Americans have, and therefore, even though we only have about a half of their GNP, we're outspending them, as even their Secretary of Defense has admitted publicly. So that, you know, we have a system that, in terms of acquisition of power, is pretty potent. Now, some of those Americans continue to insist that over the long haul, the Solzhenitsyns and people like them are going to open up our system, and we've got to continue to worry about that, and execute the proper number of lobotomies or exile them if they're too famous, but we'll keep it under control.
But are you saying that this is this difference in the dialogue between the Presidium and the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the difference between our system and the American system, is a function of political structure and personality? President Lincoln, if I read my superficial history, really had a pretty strong control over what was his role with the Secretary of War, despite Sam. Eventually, he got control. Are you saying that today he doesn't because of personality?
Well, you'll recall that, comrade, that President Lincoln announced that he would not hesitate to violate parts of the Constitution in order to preserve the overall Constitution, and he did. Now, as long as the Americans continue to let themselves be constrained by the Constitution, they're going to avoid a power structure that is monolithic like ours, and they think that's good. We know that it does permit us great advantages with regard to the accretion of power relative to that.
You were President Ford, the United States Senate, or Admiral Holloway, or General George Brown recommend a change in their system?
No, I think even that strange Admiral Zumwalt, as I read him, strongly advocates that respect for the Constitution is the great thing that the Americans have going for them. I don't think there's any possibility that they're going to try to change their system from within. And therefore, it's increasingly important that we try to carry out the kinds of objectives that we have in ways that will weaken them internally. Now, the great successes that we achieved in the Middle East those oil price increases and the inflationary impacts of them have created unemployment over there.
I
certainly do, Comrade Brezhnev. Obviously, the Arabs made the final decision, and obviously, they fear us, but obviously, our assurances that we had the military power to prevent American intervention were very important to them.
Let's drop back. If we had some occasion that the ministers put on that we really wanted to squeeze the Americans in the Western world, what is it that the Soviet armed forces could do for us to choke off that vital oil supply?
Well, now we... If you read carefully between the lines as to what the American policymakers are saying, it's quite clear that they know they no longer have the military strength to cover the significant areas of the Middle East or Japan. And it's quite clear that in any kind of a confrontation, in just the 13 years that have elapsed since the Cuban Missile Crisis, the tables have been reversed. You'll recall that I, who was even then your brilliant Chief of Naval Staff, when the present American naval leaders were still little babies, recommended to you at the time that we accommodate. We had no alternative. The Americans had us at a 4-to-1 disadvantage with strategic nuclear power, and when we did our calculations about whether or not we could break through the naval blockade at Cuba, it was clear that we couldn't. And so we did the only thing we could do. We accommodated, and the Americans gave us a graceful and face-saving way in which to accommodate. Since then, you, with your brilliant negotiating strategy, have exactly reversed the tables in the strategic balance. Within a few years, and this is another reason I'm cautioning waiting, within a few years, as we complete the deployment of our MIRVs under the Vladivostok Agreement, we will have that fourfold advantage in megatonnage and throwaway, and we will have a 2.7-fold advantage in warhead numbers. And we're matching that below the strategic umbrella with a maritime superiority that every day more clearly is perceived on both sides as giving us the advantages we need.
Well, great. We're perceived. When could you like break through that blockade?
We could do the blockade. Comrade Brezhnev, I would not recommend blockading Cuba. We've got everything in Cuba we need. I would not recommend trying to break through a blockade of Cuba if one came along. We've got everything there we need. We can already base our long-range bears out of there. We've stockpiled the things we need for the initial stages of a crisis. Sure, we...
Reconnaissance here, whatever we call them.
Right, we...
Quite regularly, haven't you?
Of course. We've, gradually increased a little bit at a time the frequency and the number of the visits and so forth. And we've got a pattern of behavior established to which the Americans have accommodated. So there's no reason for us to press any issues with regard to Cuba. As a matter of fact, soon we ought to be able to get the Americans to start... subsidizing their economy while we just get the fruits of the military relationship with them, if we work it right.
You know this, having recalled this somewhat when you retired, proclaimed for the first time in the history of the American nation, U.S. naval power is second-rate naval power.
Well,
was he overstating that to get some appropriations from Congress? How do you, Admiral Gorshkov?
Well, you were...
Second best, I believe, is what
you call it. You'll recall that I had sent you, Comrade Brezhnev, numbers of clippings during the previous 3 years that had him on record as saying that. This one just happened to be picked up at that ceremony, I think, because there was some non-Washington press there that hadn't heard it before, and so it was carried nationally. It was kind of old hat to those from Washington, because... he'd been saying that for a number of years. The answer to your question is that I agree with him. He's very careful to put odds on it, as are we. We're careful and rational. But we believe, as he does, that the odds have shifted heavily to our favor.
Well,
Well, are they heavily enough in our favor that if we wanted to today, we could choke off the American or part of the Western world oil supply?
Yes.
What that scenario might look like?
Yes, they are powerful enough that we could do it. The odds are very high. But I don't recommend we do it that way. I recommend instead that we use our power as the veiled, the velvet fist in every kind of a carrot and stick operation, such as the one we carried out in the Middle East in the Yom Kippur War, where we were offering incentives at the same time that we were making it very clear that we had the military capability to go in and would.
Well, what would be a logical next step if we wanted to?
I think the next thing we should do is work very hard to exacerbate the Middle East, keep the wound open, don't let it heal. We don't want a war down there yet. We want that to come in another 2 or 3 years. But we certainly don't want our policymakers to make the misstep of supporting any effort to bring off true peace in the Middle East. We want to keep that as a tool. We also want to keep the Cyprus thing open. Let's play the Turks and the Greeks against each other, as we have been.
Are we taking any active role in that? I have looked at what we're doing in Cyprus for quite a long while.
The Americans.
Cyprus that I don't know about that, but where's it going?
Yes, we're our policymakers have had a little difficulty deciding who we're for, because the Americans keep kind of shifting around themselves. You know, their Congress has made it quite clear that they're for the Greeks. Their administration appeared to have tilted in favor of the Turks. And that makes it very difficult for us, as those inscrutable Occidentals present that schizoid pattern for us.
Well, what have you been doing to counterpoint the Turks? Have you really been taking an active role?
This is your business, Comrade Brezhnev, but you know as well as I that we've made it clear to the Turks that we're prepared to work with them. The Turks don't trust us very much, and they're going to be very cautious about how far they go, but we're there if it'll work to the disadvantage of the United States.
Could you do anything in the Gulf Wars?
Certainly. And
I read an article somewhere that with a few mine-sweeping ships, you could seal off some vital straits. I don't know where these are. The Strait of Hormuz, another vulnerable choke point, Bab el-Mandeb, and the Strait of Tehran.
That's perfectly feasible, Comrade Brandon. We, as you know, have at least 100 times as many mines as the Americans do. And we will certainly use them as a very potent device if we ever go to war, or indeed if a crisis gets hot enough that it looks to be an intelligent policy to do so. You remember the Americans gave themselves a big leg up in the mining of Haiphong and really set back our objectives in Hanoi's by a considerable fraction there. Matter of fact, they might well have brought it off in Southeast Asia if Nixon hadn't gotten himself fouled up in that Watergate crisis. And
why wasn't Ethel Zumwalt able to sell that earlier? The mining was so obvious.
Well,
what was his problem?
We had been successful, I think, over the years in making it pretty clear that our concern and the Chinese concern for taking action against North Vietnam could well lead to an escalation of hostilities, and there was enough concern amongst the Americans about that it took extremists on their side before they were willing to take the risks, to which you'll recall we rather readily accommodated because we could see that we had the long-term game won with Nixon in the process of disemboweling himself.
But don't I recall that it took us 3 or 4 days to send the first mines north of Japan to start clearing those mines? Is there some kind of a signal we sent to the North Vietnamese at the time of the mining in May 72? Count on us, but not that much.
Sure, we played the usual sophisticated Soviet game. We counseled Hanoi to go along to sign a truce. They had a truce which was structured so favorably for them that all they needed was a little bit of a break in order to bring off their long-term objectives, and we counseled restraint in the near term and made it quite clear to them that we supported their long-term objectives. And as you recall, we, of course, kept our aid going down there and were good, loyal allies as they built their roads south through the jungles and as they hauled our supplies and trucks and missiles and so forth down into the south. And that coupled with the congressional restraint against the use of force by the United States made it possible for us to go along with Hanoi's desire to send all but two or three of their divisions down south. They increased the total power down south by nearly double as a result.
Back in November 1971, the Zumwalt and these joint chiefs tried to free some prisoners in North Vietnam on a Great Asante. And I read somewhere that Zumwalt launched the largest Navy air operation, the largest air diversion of the entire Vietnam War to free some prisoners. What's the purpose behind that? Wasn't that the largest Navy operation ever? It was a diversion.
Well, you know, it goes back, Comrade Brezhnev, to that Sir Galahad-like streak that I was talking about that the Americans have. You know, they put great premium on individual human life. We don't have to worry about that over here.
But they weren't even carrying... They were carrying flares, most of those airplanes.
Sure, but it was an important diversion. It was uncertain to Hanoi and to our own intelligence as to exactly what they were up to until...
But our airmen understand that if we sent them in enemy territory over all those sands and black and say we'd like to drop a few flares, we're going to rescue 60 or trying to rescue 60 or 70 people.
Well, of course, as you know, in our system, we wouldn't tell them unless we thought it was useful to us to do so. We would tell our newspapers what kind of a story to print, and they wouldn't necessarily know why they were there. We could make our chaps think that they were there for reasons that were more relevant to the communist theology.
But what would we tell our airmen? The men who were flying, they go out and climb in their airplanes and they see flares, not bombs. We're going to send them into the thickest American flak and air defenses.
In our case, we just tell them, you know, this is enhancing the objectives of the fatherland, and you will be told at the proper time.
What do you think Admiral Zumwalt told his people?
I don't think Admiral Zumwalt had to tell them anything. The knowledge that they were in there to help with a rescue operation was all those crazy Americans needed to feel fully dedicated and devoted to what they were doing.
But when I looked into that operation after the fact, I thought I read Admiral Zumwalt's orders, and I thought he only told the admiral that we were rescuing some prisoners. The airmen didn't know what was going on, and they were just involved in some very important operation. What kind of a system is it that builds this kind of an airman?
Well, you know, their airmen, like ours, are elite, well-trained, well-paid by the standards of their military. And they're guys who love to fly, and they don't need to be told much beyond that in the near term. Obviously, the Americans feel more constrained to level with their people than we have to with ours.
Can we go back? How do I stop that oil? You're obsessed with it.
Let me just say this, you know, Comrade Brezhnev. We've got what it takes to stop the oil if we decide to do it that way. We would lay mines. We would strike with our long-range air. We would, of course, want to have our missile ships in trail of all their high-value ships and have our submarines properly stationed, ready to strike, so that we could do the job in a good, tough, conventional first strike. As you know, we've built our Navy to be able to deal with their carriers by having peacetime trailers so that we can get the first strike in. So we've got to be able to carry that out if it is decided by the Presidium to go to war. But I don't recommend that. What we want to do is what the Americans did to us in the Cuban Missile Crisis.
array our power, and then make clear at the leadership to leadership level that we've got to have an accommodation. After all, we did it to the Americans in the Yom Kippur War.
Except that Admiral Sumwalt and his successors and General Brown and Schlesinger, these people said, if you approve this budget, our new plan, we will catch back up by some year. We're in a precarious period here until 1979 or 1980. How long is this option available to us at the rate they're going?
In my view, if the Congress of the United States maintains the average cuts that they have extracted over the last 6 years, the Americans will never catch up. They've got to present a more favorable picture than that. They don't like to talk about the realities, even in their political system. And although they can't snuff out their dissenters the way we do, things are going well. We're getting, the power balance continues to shift in our favor and has every year for the last six.
How long can you choke off those straits for me, for our fatherlander, without involving us in a really big Mediterranean NATO flap?
Well, you've got to recognize, Comrade Brezhnev, that if you decide to strike the Americans, you're risking the possibility of escalation in nuclear war. After all, they are inscrutable Occidentals. We guessed wrong on what they would do in Cambodia. We guessed wrong on what they would do in Laos. We guessed wrong on what they would do with regard to the mining of Haiphong and the bombing of Hanoi. So we're much better off to use our superior military power to confront them and then give them a carrot and a stick.
Well, do you really believe, Admiral Gorshkov, that we can read them that well now? Wasn't there a point in time shortly after President Nixon took office, 3 or 4 months later, when we found out later that this man Kissinger and the president had purposely decided to test our ability to read their intentions, and they caused all sorts of alerts and so forth? Didn't it take us something like 2 months to find out that, my God, they have been on alert and they've had all this odd traffic for several months? Have we fixed that now? Do you really think we can read their intentions that well?
Yeah, I don't admit, Comrade Brezhnev, that they fooled us. Neither do I admit that they set out to try to fool us.
Can you tell me what happened?
Off the record, I believe that that was... Chinese have called Kim Il-sung to Peking and have counseled him not to strike. And although I don't like to agree with the Chinese, I believe that that's the right advice for different reasons. They, of course, don't want him to strike because they want the American forces to stay in South Korea and in Japan and in Taiwan and in Thailand because they're more worried about us than they are the Americans. I believe that we need to restrain Kim Il-sung and let the natural play of forces within the United States lead them to withdraw their forces from South Korea, and then we can turn that crazy nut loose.
How long?
Well, you know, Comrade Brezhnev, you know the Americans better than I, but my hunch would be that this year and next, they're going to be the Congress will be fairly cautious in the aftermath of our great victories in Southeast Asia. Their great defeats. And so I would think that we're talking about something like 3 to 6 years in the future there, which is about ideal from our standpoint because that's the time at which we will have completed the massive deployment of our huge new missiles in violation of those silly understandings we achieved in May of 1972.
I'm going to turn this over in about 5 minutes.
Could I just ask, because I read about it in the traffic here from Aerospace Day and Aviation Weekend from our portion of Carolina. What about this all this traffic on flak on the F-14, F-18? What is the American Navy doing? Are they making the right choice in this mix? What would you do, General, if you had that choice?
As you know, I have been a great advocate of keeping systems as simple and as cheap as we can. I agree with Admiral Zumwalt on that, but I've been more successful than he has. However, looking at their problem, where under their system it's increasingly difficult for the Americans to retain overseas airfields, and they're having more and more trouble with their allies. They were foolish enough that they never turned them into client states the way we have. That they can't even count on using the airfields of their allies in a crisis. You'll recall that in both the Jordan crisis and the Yom Kippur War, they weren't able to use those Mediterranean airfields. So they've got to have an awful lot of power crowded into the floating airfields they've got on their aircraft carrier. And for that reason, I believe that if I were the Americans, I would be buying out those F-14s and not going for any alternative. Every square foot of deck space on those very costly aircraft carriers should be optimized with the maximum fighter capability. And I wish that we had a fighter in the Soviet Union that was the equal of that F-14. If I can come back, comrade, to the reason I keep counseling you not to force me to use my power against those Americans, we've all agreed for years that our real long-term strategic objective in the Middle East is to get control of that oil jugular. And we're damn near there. We got the oil embargo. We got the oil prices quadrupled. The American requirements for energy are going up at a fantastic rate. Our Bartolf Institute's latest monthly letter tells me that they've gone up to 37% of their oil now coming in from overseas. At about the time that our power optimizes, we're going to have the Americans, if they continue to dawdle over there with their energy problem, in a position where we can really put them in the same kind of difficulty that the Americans had Japan in World War II. They are becoming hostage to us in the Middle East, and we want to use it in a sophisticated way, and we want to get that economy of theirs hurting in embargo after embargo, brought off by the Arabs as a result of Arab-Israeli troubles. And we can work at that under the table and keep our fingers out of the cookie jar. Now, the thing we have to worry about is being so abrupt in this that we get the Americans concerned about energy. You know, they're already beginning to form organizations over there.
There's this new one, Americans for Energy, Oil,
Americans for Energy Independence.
Bud, can we break here and talk about that separately?
Right.
That's the end of side one.